Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 188 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling, Has Canola's Time to Shine Finally Arrived? About my conversation with Isaac Mattson, Oilseed Cropping Systems Extension Agronomist at Washington State University. Although wheat is my top priority, I have to admit that canola was my first love. As a reporter new to agriculture more than 30 years ago, canola was a crop that a number of Eastern Washington farmers and other advocates worked hard to launch. Some of my first field days were hosted by canola concerns, and it all sounded so good, not just the crop, but the health benefits of the oil, that I was sure the tiny black seeds were going to be the next big thing. And they were. In Canada, where it was created from the rapeseed plant, but with most of the uricic acid, which can be toxic to humans, bred out of it, the name, in fact, is a contraction of Canada and ola, which is an ancient Greek derivative of the word for oil. More than 20 million acres of canola are planted annually in Canada. As you'll hear ahead, Eastern Washington hasn't broken 100,000 acres yet, but it's moving in the right direction with a big bounce since 2016. Of course, at least part of canola's good fortune has come at the expense of other crops, particularly chickpeas, which saw prices crater after India applied tariffs on imports. I know a lot of farmers are giving canola a look this year because I've had a string of texts from city friends asking me to identify the beautiful yellow fields they're seeing in farm country. I've got to give it to canola. It is gorgeous those few weeks it blooms. But if you ask me, it has nothing on wheat when it comes to beauty throughout the growing season. You can't beat that emerald transition to gold. Isaac Mattson is a city boy whose portal to agriculture was through his family's large garden growing up. That's where he developed his affinity for plants. But as an undergraduate at Washington State University, he was still trying to figure out what to do with the rest of his life when he took a soils class and discovered the answer. He received his bachelor's degree in integrated plant sciences, field crop management, and left Pullman for the Columbia Basin. He farmed for a year, and although he said it was a massively useful experience, in 2012 he jumped at the chance to come back to WSU to get his PhD studying canola root growth. Karen Sowers, his predecessor, left the position in early 2019 to become full-time executive director of the Pacific Northwest Canola Association. You can get more information about the crop at the organization's website at pnwcanola.org. That's pnwcanola.org. Mattson was named to a reorganized position in October 2019. In addition to canola, he'll be in charge of running a variety testing program for camelina, safflower, and sunflowers. I begin our conversation by asking him to explain how the variety testing program for oil seeds, primarily canola, differs from the wheat variety trials that farmers are more familiar with.
So the variety testing program, which is, it's not like a traditional variety testing program, partially just because research infrastructure limitations, but it's a strip. So we do large scale trials on growers' fields. So with field scale equipment, we'll plant different varieties, usually the leading varieties from the region. So not that many entries, not what you would expect from, say, the wheat variety testing program. So my position is sort of a new position. It's a combination of a few previous positions. And one of the previous positions was Karen Sowers, who was the extension specialist for canola. And she had developed that program. And so that was already in place. And that's just focused on canola. But we also do work with camelina, you know, actually flax, sunflowers. I haven't personally worked with safflower yet, but I'm sure I'll get around to it eventually.
Okay. So you're coming at this from the agronomic side. What about the markets for these alternatives?
I think the markets are always reflected in the acreage. Canola, obviously, is the largest oilseed crop per acre around here. We actually had planted, at least the most recent reports are in 2020, we had 80,000 acres or 20. Yeah. So some of that was fall seeded canola, but total, we had 80,000 acres of canola seeded in Washington this year, which is a really dramatic increase from say 2016 when we were at 33,000 acres. So we've been seeing this increase. And so that's really market driven. You know, Viterra has their crusher out there in Warden. And so I think that's the big driver of making canola a viable crop around here, is having somewhere to take it, that it can be processed, you know, and turned into oil and then feed meal. So I think that's why we see canola being the largest. And then, you know, sunflowers, there's a small market for sunflowers around, mostly birdseed. And then flax is really niche at this point in the region, and the same with safflower. So that's why you don't see those grown on such a large acreage. And I think why you do see the canola on that larger acreage is because the processing is here.
I once did a story on a farmer in Whitman County who fuels all of his equipment with camelina. I mean, he had this Rube Goldberg distillery, and it was cool as heck, but of course it probably wasn't cost effective because diesel is so cheap. Why are we even looking at camelina anymore?
I think camelina, you know, it's one of those things where there's two reasons you would look at camelina. One of the reasons you might look at camelina is, and this was kind of the initial push in the region, was from a biofuels perspective, and then the other is from is an edible oil. You know, and so I should emphasize that's most of what the canola we're growing right now. It's not going to biodiesel. It's really going to food grade oils. And so camelina is the same way. The people that are actually growing and selling camelina in the region, most of that's going to food, and camelina oil is one of those things they consider it kind of it's got high levels of omega-3s, so they think it's a really healthy oil. And so it's almost sold as a health product almost. And so I think that's actually more the future. You know, biodiesel very rarely, I think, pencils out in the short run against diesel that you can just refine out of oil coming out of the ground. So I think that's maybe long term. I think there's some thinking that it's strategic to have these biofuels available, but I think short run, really what we're looking at is the food grade side of things.
Okay. So canola has been the next big crop in the Pacific Northwest for more than 30 years. What have been the obstacles preventing it from achieving its widespread use as an alternative crop?
One of those is the market. So I think the reason we're seeing this pretty dramatic increase in acreage over the last 4 years is related to the pulse price getting worse and worse. Garbs, for instance, and around Pullman were just acres and acres of garbs a few years back. And I think what's happened is as that garb price has fallen pretty dramatically, it's kind of people need something to rotate their wheat with still. And so they've gone to rotating canola in. So that's, I think, one of the really big, big factors. I think the other factors are sometimes a lack of knowledge about growing it, and it can be, canola can be a pretty finicky crop. And so you might try and grow it 1 year and have a kind of bad experience with it. And that might make you not want to grow it in the future. It's really fragile when it's young, and then practically unkillable when it's big. And so that's kind of, I think, one of the issues with it is, so one of the things that I'm really interested in looking at is actually stand establishment and how to better establish stands, especially in winter canola. And then, you know, I think we were, especially in the early years, we were working out a lot on nitrogen and different fertility plant densities, and also you know, genetics for the region, because it was new. And if you think about wheat, and we've been breeding wheat out here since, I think that goes all the way back probably to the founding of WSU. So maybe since the 1890s, you know, we've only been working on canola, regionally adapted canola, for, I don't know, 20, 30 years, you know. So that's, it's a much shorter, we don't have as much work done on it over these last years as we do on, say, a crop like wheat. And so I think there's, you have the genetics, and then working out some of the management practices And I think we are getting, overall, we're being able to increase the yield of the canola regionally. And that obviously makes it a little more lucrative if you can get a good yield off.
Now you mentioned just a moment ago about the finicky nature of canola, and it seems like stand establishment is one of the biggest hurdles.
Yeah, so winter canola is pretty a pretty tricky crop, I would say. And planting date is one of the things that we're actually looking at. So actually, today I'm going out to plant a early seeded canola trial, and so it's July 10th. One of the issues with the early seeding is, like you were mentioning, that the plants can get so large in the fall that they'll actually be more vulnerable to the cold in the winter. And so one of the things, or a few of the things we're looking at, is controlling the fall growth with plant growth regulators, which are essentially synthetic hormones. And then also we're going to be looking at intercropping it with oats to help it emerge and what that can do. And we've done that 1 year and got some interesting results where it looked like emergence was more uniform when we had the oats in there. And so that's kind of one of our big focuses is trying to get those stands established. We also looked at things like in-furrow moisture. That didn't seem to be a good idea. So right now what I'm leaning towards is, you know, plant when there is, you're definitely get into good moisture, and then try and keep the plant small so that you can survive through the winter. And so I've actually run a few grazing trials on that also, successfully, where we grazed it and we got seed yields off of it.
Now the Davenport area that you're going to visit right now, I mean, that precipitation zone is about 12 to 15 inches. In what sort of precipitation zones can canola be grown?
I haven't ever seen any down in the Horse Heaven Hills, but you'll see it all the way out by Elmira. So you'll definitely see it in the and up on the Waterville Plateau. So you'll definitely see it in the sub-12 rainfall zones. And I think winter canola does well in those areas because you can plant into summer fallow. And so I think summer fallow is the best way to do winter canola. And then in the higher rainfall zones, we grow more spring canola, because you can fit those spring crops in. And winter canola is really tricky in the high rainfall zones, because frequently by the time the crop is off and you actually have water back in your profile, you're pushing a planting date that's just going to be too late for the canola. It's going to be too small going into the winter. I will say, I think there's a missed opportunity in the high rainfall zone that I see frequently. The last, not this year, but so 2019, we had a fair bit of preventative plant acres going on, you know, where it was too wet to plant in the spring. And I think you could come into those fields in late July, early August, and put some canola in, and probably walk away with a fairly decent canola crop that next year. I saw a field like that out near Endicott a few years back, and we had a trial in it, and we were getting 5,500 pound canola yields off of that. So that's obviously, when you start talking about yields like that, I think you can actually start competing with wheat when you start talking about those really high winter canola yields. So I think that's an opportunity that we're going to have to look at in the future when we do hit preventative plant situations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the spring.
Now, Curtis Henning is sort of the grandfather of the canola business out here in eastern Washington, and he's told me that many times a particular canola crop has made him more than wheat. Can you elaborate on that? I mean, what's your experience?
Yeah, and I think you're definitely seeing that for more for people growing winter canola than people growing spring canola, just because you do have the higher yields, and that area frequently is closer to Warden, so those growers tend to you know, instead of storing it somewhere, they haul it directly to the crusher, and so they can get a little better price. And so I think that's one of the factors, is getting that price out there at Warden. And so I think it's a combination of that. Can you grow the high yielding canola, and can you get a good price for it? And then I have seen it be competitive with wheat. I actually have worked with a grower down south of here who's had some decent canola crops, but they've found it to be, at least a few years, they were netting more on their canola than they were netting on their wheat. So I think that's definitely happening, and it's really dependent on the relative prices and what kind of yields we're squeezing out of it.
Now, that canola crusher down in Warden has been down there for quite a while, and the industry still didn't take off after it was put in. I'm just curious, why now?
Part of that has to do with a few years back, so I'm going to get my years wrong here, but I think it was 2014 or 15, Viterra took over the management of that plant. They're a Canadian company that has a lot of experience with canola, and so they took it over, and I think that's when really the dependability of the market started to come online then, when they were able to offer, I think, more consistent prices. But I think that's a lot of that, because for a while, you know, it was kind of, you might grow a great canola crop, but then it wasn't always guaranteed that that market was going to be there when it came time to sell it. And so that was really a pretty massive issue. You know, you can't really afford to grow something if you're not sure how the selling is going to go.
Right, right. So 30 years ago, when I was a young reporter and I was going out to these canola events, we were really hoping for something big to happen. In that same time period, something big did happen in Canada, and canola acreage exploded there. Why there and not here?
Yeah, so I think there's actually some regional stresses to the crop that's part of that. This is one of the things I think about quite frequently, is why, you know, I was up in Saskatchewan last summer, and that place is just full of canola, and it's like, why is that like that? And down here, we don't have so much. I think some of it is our summer heats, and this is totally unbacked by data. This is me theorizing. You know, the heat at flowering can be a pretty big problem for canola production, and I think that's something that we have go on here more, is that we tend to have, you know, especially with our spring canola, when it's flowering, it can get pretty hot, and so that can actually shut your bloom down. So I was working with a grower, and we had a trial in. The great stand, looked really good, but the heat turned on right when the canola started flowering, and I think the average yield on the trial was something like 700 pounds an acre, and so that's obviously not going to work. And so I think that's where you get the one of the issues I think that differentiates us from Canada. That's probably the biggest sort of environmental issue. And then, you know, Canada is kind of, well, it's the home of canola, and so I think they're just always a little bit ahead of us on probably the research and the genetics.
Okay, all right. You know, back in the day, when I was going to these canola field days, it was always said that wheat following canola was going to do better. You know, I've seen other studies since then that might say that's not true. I'm curious, from your perspective, is wheat following canola going to yield better?
It really depends, actually. So sometimes, frequently, it will be better. Then sometimes, in some areas, it'll actually be worse, the wheat yield following canola. And the best theory that we have as to why that is actually because canola has a no association with a root fungus. So there's this fungus called Arbuscular Mycorrhizae, and we abbreviate it by saying AMF. And most plants have this association with the AMF fungi. And so the way you can think about it is that it increases the surface area of the roots. And so it actually increases the efficiency of the plant at taking up water and nutrients. So it's a really great beneficial symbiote for most plants. Well, canola doesn't host, and most brassicas actually don't have a relationship with that fungi. So there's been studies showing that if you are in fallow areas and you're growing canola, you can actually decrease your AMF populations over time in your soil. And so that can be an issue for the following crops, is that you might not have the populations of AMF you were hoping for. And so this is actually a problem I'm working on solving by incorporating intercrops into the canola. So this early seeded canola project, we're actually seeding oats in with it, and oats will have high levels of AMF. And then we're also looking at pea, canola intercrops that will all be harvested together. And peas are also hosts of AMF. And so that's one of the theories why you would see a decreased yield after canola. And then there's a whole host of reasons you'll see an increased yield after canola. I think one of the big things we're seeing, right, is people are using canola, especially Roundup Ready canola, basically as a tool in their weed control toolbox. And then another thing is diseases, right? So if you're in a wheat-dominated system, you're going to break up that disease cycle by including the canola. And so I think there's a lot of benefits to having it. And then sometimes you get into a situation where maybe you weren't going to have those disease and weed problems. And so you grow the canola in there and then you deplete some of your soil's AMF, and then that leads to a decreased yield.
All right. I've found that most of the choices farmers make boil down to dollars and cents. Many farmers need the crop with the best bottom line in order to keep the operation afloat. In other words, thinking about the land might be secondary to thinking about the farm. Do you think farmers are too focused on what the crop in the field earns or loses rather than focusing on what the crop in the field provides for subsequent crops?
So, you know, that's a really good question. And I personally don't farm. So I hate to say anybody's too focused on one thing or another, because you gotta make sure that business works, you know? And so I think ideally what we're looking for in research is right, we're trying to provide something that has a good bottom line, makes the dollars and cents, but then at the same time, can provide some resources for the soil or fix some of the problems that we might have from, you know, years of, well, we're well over 100 years of farming in the Palouse, right? And in Eastern Washington now, and some of our soils are definitely showing some soil health and quality issues due to that. And so rotation can be a powerful tool in reversing some of those problems. But I think one of the things that we really, as researchers, need to stay focused on is that it's got to make money. You know, you can't go out of business this year trying to save the farm 100 years from now. So you have to have something that can make money this year and also protect the soil over the next, you know, 20 years. So I really like I work with actually a lot of farmers who I think have that mindset. They're very good businessmen trying to make the dollars and cents work this year, but they're also looking to the future and passing that farm on through the generations and wanting to hand down a farm that has, you know, even better soil than when they got it. And I think that's really inspiring to work with those growers. And I think it's actually one of the great privileges of my job is to work with people like that.
Okay, is there a rotation that works particularly well with canola? I mean, of course, I'm interested in wheat. I'm a wheat guy, but yep. You know, when you're looking at rotations, is, you know, crop A, B, C?
So I think you can reorder things a variety of ways. One of the interesting things I'm seeing coming out is as we have more and more grassy weed problems that are being really hard to control in wheat, is we're having people try and stack broadleafs, you know, so we'll have somebody go, say, garbs, canola, winter wheat. And I think if you're growing Roundup Ready canola, just be careful about stacking those broadleafs. You know, I've seen some fields where it was Roundup Ready canola and then garbs, and the canola really came in there and caused problems later coming back. So I think maybe a better way to do it, if you're going to stack your broadleafs like that, is to go garbs, then canola, then into your winter wheat. And you can probably reduce your nitrogen inputs, you know, in the canola then coming off of the garb ground. So I think that would be a different way, a better way of looking at it. And that will give you, you know, two good years of grassy weed control. And so that hopefully, especially with things like Italian rye, that can help you decrease the seed bank significantly. If you get good control on Italian rye for 3 years, if you don't let it drop its seed, I think there's something like only 5% of the seeds are still left in the ground. I think it can be a really powerful tool there for weed control. The other thing to watch out for in the dry land is I wouldn't want to go winter peas, winter canola, winter wheat, because I think you have to worry about conserve. You want to conserve residue out there you know, with the fallows in between, you'd really want to make sure that you're conserving residue. So it's better to have that wheat in there between the broadleaf crops.
You said in 2016 that you had 30,000 acres of canola, and now it's 2020, 4 years later, we have around 80,000 acres of canola. Does that mean in 2024 we're going to have 160,000 acres?
I certainly hope so. that would be great for me if we did get up to that acreage. Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But I do think there's, you know, I forget what the capacity of that Warden plant is, but they can take a lot more canola than we're growing. And so if we can, there's a lot of room to grow into this, into the market of that crusher. And so I think that's, I'm hoping we continue that growth curve up.
I'm hoping the growth curve can be maintained as well. Although wheat is a terrific crop, the entire system performs better when rotations are included. Wheat will always be the king in the region. We have the perfect climate, but every king needs a court, and canola, along with chickpeas, lentils, and peas, including winter peas, fill that role. Of course, the alternative has to pencil out. As a farmer said to me a long time ago, if you're not farming for the money, it's called gardening. I hope you enjoyed episode 188, or what I entitled, Has Canola's Time to Shine Finally Arrived? About my conversation with Isaac Mattson, oilseed cropping systems extension agronomist at Washington State University. Please join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It.
We're all children of a special treat. In times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.